Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Brian Kramer has bachelor's degrees in psychology, health science, and social science. He has taught in elementary schools and currently lives in Chico, where he performs as a musician. His first book was Why I Slept with My Therapist. He has now a second book, Spring, The First 20 Years, My Memoirs. And before we start, Brian, do you need a cough drop?
No, thank you.
I'm not asking because you've been coughing. You know why I'm asking.
Absolutely.
Tell the listeners what a cough drop meant to you at some point in your life.
Well, when I was a young boy, maybe 11 or 12, and playing the piano at St. Dominic's Catholic Church in Orland, I was having panic attacks, and my father would give me a cough drop. It would calm me down. It was a focus. And so I always liked cough drops after that as a sort of meditation and calming down.
Well, that was pretty young to be being responsible for the music in a church and being an organist. So I think most people would feel a little, at least a set of nerves at being playing the organ there at such a young age. Now, the title of your book, Spring, The First 20 Years, My Memoirs. And that, by way of explanation of your title, I'd like for you to read from your prologue. And this is how you divided your life into cycles.
Sure. I have divided my life into nature cycles of spring, summer, fall, and winter, each comprising 20 years. It is my belief that everything in our lives is related to everything else, and as such, we are born in the spring, labor in the summer, reap a harvest in the fall, and prepare for death in winter. Spring has always begun the cycle again.
And you also say something that a lot of us, it's not new information, it's just kind of hard to wrap our minds around. And you say that time is an illusion.
Yes, sir.
Read that from your prologue, Brian.
Sure. Time is an illusion. It is a relative term, such as left and right or up and down. It is a useful concept to communicate directionality, but nothing miraculous happens on January 1st at 12:01:01 a.m. that makes that moment the marking of a new year or a new day or, for that matter, a new minute or new second. We live in an eternal present moment of here and now in which an infinite variety of experiences exist simultaneously. Because this is true, I am every age I've ever been all at once. When I write of my experiences as a child, I, the child, am writing of my present reality. I never disappeared. I'm still here, and I know how I feel and what I do and what others do to me. I am present, and admittedly using vocabulary and expressions I learned later to express myself now. But it's still me, and every experience that has ever been me is here and present and ready to tell my story from my firsthand account. This is what makes writing this book exciting, because I get to tell you how I feel in this moment, knowing my own future, but able to tell you what I am experiencing before I know my future. I didn't stop being three. I simply added four and five and six and so on. I, the three-year-old, shall begin this book detailing the first 20 years of my life, what I shall call the spring of my life. And I, the older, seasoned Brian, shall finish it.
So you set up your book as the first, and I'm assuming that you're probably already working on the second in this series.
I'm almost done.
Because you say our lives are cycles, and this first cycle is the spring of your life, the first 20 years. And that's why I see you call this my memoirs, because when I first read it, I thought, memoirs, plural? Because this is the first in this series. So you start then your first chapter when you're just 3 years old. And as I'm reading it, I think, well, gosh, I don't remember things when I was 3 years old. But this seemed real to me when I was reading it. How do you know, how do you recall what you were like as a three-year-old, Brian?
Well, I clearly remember that experience that I talk about. I'm not sure how I do. I've talked to friends who remember even younger than that.
I do have a friend who said he could remember before he was able to talk because he wanted to tell his mother something and he didn't have the words to tell her and he found it very frustrating to do that. So you are able to go back to where did you grow up?
Capay. It's just north of Hamilton City. And people probably don't know Hamilton City either. It's near Orland.
And you grew up on a dairy farm.
Yes.
So that in itself was an education that our city children these days don't get. We don't get that close contact with animals and nature that you grew up with. And you mentioned you had a dog named Tippy. And most children are very fond of their dogs. But a dog also gave you a chance to see the cycles of life and death. Because Tippy would have as many as 12 puppies at a time. So you grew up on this farm, being able to grow up with animals. And the time came when you had to go off to kindergarten. And I do remember my first day of kindergarten because I was disoriented. My mother didn't come in and say, okay, here's the classroom and here's your teacher. And she just left me off at the door and I had to find my way. So my first day of kindergarten was rather traumatic. But when I read about yours, I thought, oh my gosh, well, at least that didn't happen to me. Here you are, this little five-year-old, and they haven't shown you where the bathroom is, and you wet your pants, Brian. And that's so sad that that happened. And it didn't seem like you got a lot of sympathy.
No. No, I didn't.
Because you didn't live that far away, but you had to tough it out the rest of the day.
Yes. You know, again, I remember that as if it was just this morning. And yet it's 50 years ago, because I'm 55 now. And I think that the difficult part was being afraid to ask for what I needed. And if there's anything that's changed over the course of my life, it's been the ability to ask. In fact, sometimes people say I ask too often for too much. But I communicate my needs now. And if people say no, I can always live with that. What I can't live with is the thought that I didn't have the courage to ask for what I wanted or needed and maybe did without for no reason.
Do you know, that's an interesting lesson for all of us. Well, for me, for example, at this age in my life, it took me a while to learn to ask because I think a lot of times we're too indirect. And it sounds like you've learned to ask clearly what you want. And if the answer is no, you say you can live with that.
Yes, absolutely.
So that was an important lesson. You probably didn't dawn on you at the age of five, but later, because that example sticks out in your memory so clearly, you now know, okay, there's, if I don't ask for what I need and want, that's what can happen.
Yes. And later in my story, I'll bring that back up again with the need to ask.
Well, the other thing that you mentioned in your book, you mentioned that your grandparents, for example, had a restaurant. And so you grew up with a circle of family around you. You had brothers, sisters, godparents.
Godparents.
And the reason I mention your godparents is what happened to these godparents that you had?
Well, I was only about 7 years old. And on New Year's Day, they got in a car accident and died. And my godparents were, in my mind, like parents. And I knew that if my parents had died for some reason, that my godparents would take care of me, keep me safe. And so I was just devastated that they had died so suddenly. And I really was afraid that what if my own parents were to die? How horrible that would be. And I just was pretty much inconsolable. It was really the first time that I faced death.
My guest is Brian Kramer, and he has written a second book. This, I view this, Brian, as a prequel to your first book, really. This gives us the background. Oh, this is what happened to Brian when he was a little kid. And the title of this book is Spring, the First 20 Years. And this is going to be a series of his memoirs, plural. So this, your godparents were killed in an accident. But then there was also a 28-year-old. You don't expect a 28-year-old to die. And you had this aunt that died of cancer. And what was upsetting for us as readers was that you react. I think a lot of children, this happens to children, that something terrible happens and they blame themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you were worried that it was somehow your fault that your 28-year-old aunt died.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to blame yourself?
Well, at the time, I had no idea that I had what is a disorder called obsessive compulsive disorder. But even much younger than that, I was had all kinds of unusual fears and had to do things in groups of numbers to try to keep bad things from happening to my family members. And so I had already developed what's called magical thinking, this fear of somehow causing evil or death or something bad through my thoughts. And so when my mother got the call that my aunt was in the hospital, this is the day before she actually died, I immediately started thinking about my thoughts. What if I think she's going to die? Will that make her die? And so at this age, which again was about the same time my godparents had died, this was maybe a year later, which honestly is a lot for a little kid to handle so much death of really close people. It was, and also it's amazing how just even telling the story, like I told you earlier, I am still in here. The 7 and 8 year old child that went through this is still in here telling this story again. And so I still feel the same emotion as I felt at the time. But I remember just going through my mind, what am I thinking about? I hope I don't cause her to die by thinking about her dying. And then she did die. And it was a horrible thing. And I had to reassure myself that I didn't cause it, because at this time I wasn't able to tell these scary thoughts to my parents.
Well, in this chapter, you have another resource as to what was going on, because your mother kept a diary.
Mm-hmm.
So you had access to what she had written down in her diary. What were the kind of things that she wrote in her diary, Brian?
Well, she wrote that I was having stomach problems, that I was having fears. She wasn't sure why, but she knew that something wasn't quite right with me.
She could tell that something was wrong, but you couldn't tell her what was wrong.
No, no.
Well, in your book, you describe having a dream. And it was a dream that a lot of people have these kinds of dreams. They dream about something before it happens. And you say that you had an unusual dream. You were walking across a bridge all alone, and suddenly you began falling off the end of the bridge. Would you can read that paragraph for us?
Oh, I could tell this story
better. Oh, just tell us then what that dream was about.
Yes. I, like you said, was walking across a bridge in the dream. The bridge had broken, and I fell off the end of the bridge, and I grabbed the edge and pulled myself up to safety. And within a matter of hours, the next morning, I was walking along the top of it was a big, kind of like a swimming pool edge, but it was raised above the ground, and it was used for watering the fields. And I was walking along the top edge of this. This was like 3 feet off the ground. And I slipped, which I had never, ever slipped before and never slipped after. But I slipped and I fell to the side. I grabbed the edge exactly like the dream. I felt exactly the same feelings as the dream. And I realized that I had dreamt that before it happened. And that was just hours before.
Yeah, you say that you found yourself experiencing the exact feeling you had in your dream a few hours earlier. And maybe at that time you didn't know that other people have these precognitive dreams. Did you realize that?
No, I wasn't aware of it at all.
Yeah, yeah. Other people do. They dream about something before it happens.
Yeah.
And typically it's the emotion that is recalled, maybe not the details. Like your details of the dream and the reality were slightly different, but the feeling
mm-hmm.
was that same feeling. I'll be back with my guest, Brian Kramer, after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Brian Kramer, author of Spring, The First 20 Years. Now, I want to go back to a time when you were just a youngster, and there was this, I guess I'll call it a contest, where young kids were invited to collect bottle caps, and then you could bid on toys.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened when you did that? Who helped you collecting your bottle caps?
Well, it was a promotion for Pepsi Cola, I believe. And so my dad went on his motorcycle all around Chico and Orland and collecting these caps. And so we had a lot of caps, probably hundreds of them by the
Whereas
time.
Whereas the other kids probably had maybe 40 or 50.
Probably.
And you are coming dragging in 900 bottle caps.
I had a big bag of bottle caps, that's for sure. And so anyway, this is a Saturday morning program for local children to be on. And so I went on, and there were all these prizes, and I knew I was on TV, and I was nervous about that. And so the man asked if we wanted to bid on a prize, and I know it wasn't a specific prize. We were just supposed to start bidding and see who would bid the highest to be the first child to pick a prize. And the kids were saying 20 and 30 and 35, and I yelled something like 950 or whatever it was. My whole cash. I didn't know you should bid just a little bit over
what others are bidding.
So my father, after driving all those miles and spending hours and hours collecting those bottle caps, must have thought, oh my.
He spent them all at once.
Yes. And then so to make it even more drama, the man asked me to come up and stand before the cameras with him. And there are all these lights on me. And I'm looking at these prizes, and there's this tall, beautiful doll among the whole prizes with long blonde hair. And for whatever reason, I mean, today I don't really know why, honestly, but at that time I thought, that beautiful doll, I want that doll. And so when the man asked me which of the prizes I wanted, I said, I want that doll. And he probably nowadays wouldn't say this, but he said, why? Kind of like, why would you want a doll? And
because nowadays they make a point of giving children access to toys that would be preferred by boys and girls, and not distinguishing. Give the little girl a toy truck.
Yes.
And give the boy a doll. But then, back in those days, what, Brian?
Yeah, this
you
was
a doll?
Somewhere around 1968 or 70 or something. And so I was pretty quick thinking. I realized I had made a pretty big error of judgment on television. And so I said, it's for my sister. And I believe it did go to my sister.
So she got the benefit.
But I got myself out of it. So, but we went on another time. And that second time I went on, I got a gender, well, what
pretty
I would call
neutral,
back then,
it sounded, yeah.
A gender appropriate back
yeah.
then. Nowadays it's fine.
Well, I mentioned that you were growing up on a farm. And you had access to nature. But I think all of your life, I get the impression that nature was, you call it your salvation. You have mm-hmm. a chapter called Salvation, mm-hmm. when you talk about how important nature was to you, and I assume still is.
Absolutely.
And how did that manifest, this interest in nature?
I don't know what brought it about. It just seemed so natural. I was so in touch with nature. It was peaceful. It was green. It was alive. It was everything good. I had so much anxiety as a child with the obsessive compulsive disorder that this was peaceful. That just brought me, you know, serenity.
But you also collected things from nature. What kinds of things did you collect?
Well, I had an insect collection, which I would never do again, because I had to kill these little things. You know, as a child, I really didn't have much sense of what it meant to be killing innocent creatures. But I had an insect collection, I had a leaf collection, I had shell collection, I had stamp collection. Again, the obsessive compulsive disorder, often people collect things too. So not everybody that collects things has OCD, but I certainly had it, and that was one of the ways that I was manifesting it.
Well, it came in somewhat handy. You were very organized.
Very organized. I would organize my mother's books by title and then I'd organize them by size and height, and then I decided title was better, and everything, the house was immaculate because I was pulling everything out of the shelves of the kitchen and cleaning everything down to the smallest detail. And the thought does come to my mind as I'm talking is that if parents are listening to this and they have a child who is such an immaculate cleaner to the degree that they're kind of worried about them, or maybe they line things up north, south, east, west, or maybe they have to have everything exactly a certain way, or they scream or they cry, that these are not for sure that the child has this disorder that I had, but it's possible, and it's something they might consider. Children can really suffer without parents knowing why they're suffering, and even sometimes knowing that they're suffering.
In fact, that comes through in your book, and I think it makes us more sensitive adults. When we see what you went through and you couldn't tell people, then we think, oh my gosh, what is going on with this child? What can I do? Mm-hmm. And for example, not many children like to wash dishes. Mm-hmm. You actually like to wash dishes.
Yeah, I still love to wash dishes, actually.
And that's not a behavior we'd want to discourage. If I was your mother, I'd say, well, Brian, sure, go ahead, dear.
Yes. Let me give you an example, though, of how extreme it was. After I cleaned the entire kitchen, and I'm talking about cleaning inside the shelves, all the dust, I've finished the entire kitchen. I've mopped the floor. I've wiped everything. And then I've dumped the trash out. And I'm searching the floor for dust, and I see a little speck of dirt, and I push my finger on it, and I throw it in the trash can, and then I can't feel comfortable until I empty the trash can again. Now, it's perfect. I just stare in it in this perfect sense that all is well with the universe for a moment, and then I move on to the next room and do the same thing again.
I mentioned that you played the organ, or you mentioned that you played the organ in your church, but when you started piano lessons, you said you were too scared. When your mother says, Brian, you want to take piano lessons? I'm too scared to take piano lessons. So how did you resolve that?
Well, my mom offered to take lessons with me. This wonderful person out in Capay named Irma Kalb, who is my mom's good friend still and my friend, she taught me for 2 years. From the moment I touched the key of a piano, I was in love with the piano. I still am. I could easily describe it as my best friend. It changed the course of my life. And my mom only had to take lessons with me for about a year before she was able to quit because I was hooked. And I just recently played for a funeral. I think it was 70th, 75th, something in there in the 70s. And as I play and I was singing the Ave Maria, I felt like some higher consciousness was just playing through me, singing through me. I go into a whole nother space when I perform. And I've always experienced that since I was a child. And because I had so many fears as a child, music became, like nature, an amazing an amazing peaceful experience. And it still serves that purpose for me.
You know, a lot of composers describe how they came up with a composition as if they were not the originator of this composition, that it came through them. Mm-hmm. And you have a sensitivity that you did not pursue, but you have a chapter on telepathy and clairvoyance, mm-hmm. Brian. Brian, what, and you were young when you decided you would going to explore that.
Yes.
Would you like to read or tell us about that experiment in your life?
Sure, I'll read it here. This is, in about fourth or fifth grade, I suddenly decided I was going to try to read another child's mind. Perhaps I was reading about extrasensory perception at the time. I don't remember what prompted this little experiment, but I asked another student to think of a number between 1 and 10. Instantly, I knew the number and I named it. He was happy at my good success. I asked him to think of another one. Again, I knew the number he had chosen and correctly told him what it was. I asked a different child to do the same thing, and again, instantly I knew what it was, as if I could read their minds. 3 good guesses would be my explanation if it were not for the fact that in these 3 instances, I knew that I knew. I could feel the answer in each case, but as quickly as it came, the ability and confidence disappeared.
Well, there's another time that you used your ESP, if we want to call it extrasensory perception, and that is, and this is something that so many of us wish we could do, Brian, is we can't find our keys. Mm. Gosh, if we just could, if we had ESP, we could find those keys. Mm-hmm. And you actually did find your keys.
Yes, absolutely. And I may have had some help from St. Anthony. I'll tell you what happened. So first of all, this is technically not telepathy. What I'm about to tell you is clairvoyance or remote viewing. But I had lost the car keys. My parents were upset. Fortunately, the car was not locked, but we weren't going to go anywhere without the keys. And so my middle name is Anthony, and Anthony is a patron saint of lost items. So I prayed to St. Anthony. I'd been raised Catholic, and I prayed to St. Anthony, and the moment I asked, where are my keys, I saw my keys in my mind. And I saw them not only where they were located, which was in the back seat of the car on the right-hand side, but I saw them exactly how they were positioned. And I ran out there, opened the back door, pulled up the back seat. There on the right side were my keys positioned exactly as I had seen them. And so whether St. Anthony was interceding for me or I was experiencing a clairvoyant moment, I do not know, perhaps both. But that has, I've had experiences like that, and I'm very happy to have had those kinds of experiences.
So you mentioned St. Anthony, and Catholics, of course, know, and even non-Catholics know St. Anthony. So what was your relationship to the Catholic Church or religion generally when you were growing up?
Well, I was very devout, and my faith meant a lot to me, but I also was very scared. There's not just God and Jesus, there's and angels, there's demons and Satan, and there's scary parts of my Catholicism. And so, again, with the obsessive compulsive disorder, those fears were exaggerated. Something we haven't mentioned, and maybe you're being polite to not ask, but I'm going to bring it up anyway because I think it's important, is that I was sexualized very young. About 8 or 9 years old, a relative sexualized me, and the person was about 5.5 years older than I am. So he was a child as well. But when one combines the guilt, which I felt over that secret, combined with an obsessive compulsive nature, combined with religion that involves demons and Satan as well as angels and God, it can make for a very complicated childhood. And so I felt very close to God, but I also had a lot of crazy fears, and I started to fear that maybe I was evil like the devil, because I had learned in my faith that Satan was a liar. And I felt like a liar. I had these sexual guilt things going on, and had gotten involved. I had involved myself with a couple, 3 other neighbor boys, as well as this relative. And so I had so many secrets as a child. And this is why today I don't have secrets. This is why I write. This is why I am so compulsively honest now, because I see the damage that secrets can do in children's lives. And so to the parents that are listening, I can only say, ask your children questions. Don't hesitate to ask them how they're really doing. And if you sense there's something wrong, keep asking until you find out.
Do you know, Brian, I wish that I had read your book some years ago. It might have helped with this young woman who was, before she started school, she was a happy, smiling. And about the time she started school, she became withdrawn, and she had maybe some OCD tendencies too. And we as a family really didn't figure anything was wrong. I mean, she excelled academically, and I guess she was in her 30s or 40s before she admitted having been molested. It was jaw-dropping. Who in the world? And then it came out that it was her grandfather-in-law. It was not a blood relative. But it just destroyed her life, really. But nobody knew what had happened. And she kept that secret. And even her personality was almost like, well, everything's fine, but it wasn't. And at least you didn't have that facade that everything's fine, because you had these terrors and torments that were visible, even though people didn't know why. You didn't, your family didn't know what was going on. And you lived with that secret. So that's another thing you say now, not going to keep secrets.
I did finally come out and talk to my dad about it when I was about 10 years old. So that was a tremendous relief, was to tell my dad. But then again, being OCD, I had to tell my dad every single detail. I kept thinking that if he knew that detail, he might not love me. So I would tell him the next day another detail. And then I would think of something else. And this just kept going on and on. And there was a point where he finally said, you know what, you need to stop telling me this because you're just tormenting yourself. And at first I felt like I was rejected, because that's what I feared, that somehow I was going to be rejected. But then this is when God, higher power, loving consciousness, whatever you want to call it, stepped in and said, Brian, I just heard as clearly as anything, your father is right. Now, you are only tormenting yourself. That's what God said. And I just so believe in a higher consciousness. And I believe that although that higher consciousness is frequently quiet from our standpoint, I mean, I think it's shouting at us from butterflies and honeybees and flowers and all beautiful things. But on some level, it's quiet. But on those moments when it really makes a difference, I think that being steps in and speaks clearly. And that being certainly did that in that moment and said, you are only tormenting yourself.
Well, before that, before you finally told your dad what was going on, you said you couldn't contain your anxiety any longer. You got so depressed. You couldn't make it through the day without crying. And so your dad knew something was wrong. You said it seemed like I cried for days. My father tried to get me to talk. Finally, my dad came to my bedroom and insisted, Brian, you've got to talk to me. What is going on? And that's when you told him about these things that you'd done with Uncle Mike, this uncle that was 5.5 years older than you. And your dad said, it's going to be okay. And so you felt elated, you say is your word. And you were relieved, felt joy, and you felt so much love for your dad that he still loved you, even though you had done those things that you thought were so unforgivable. And then you say, my father must have made special arrangements with the priest.
Mm-hmm.
So you and he got on his motorcycle, rode the 10 miles to Orland, where the priest was ready to hear your confession.
Mm-hmm.
And then were you able to tell the priest?
Yes. I told the priest, you know, not every detail like my father, but I told him enough details. And, you know, as a typical priest would do, he, you know, said that God forgave me for all those things and I need to move on in life and not worry about them and not do them anymore, and gave me, you know, some, say a certain number of Hail Marys and Our Fathers, and which I did, and rode home with my father elated.
Yeah, that's what you say. You left the church a new person.
Yes. Although I must say that OCD is terrible, because a very short time later, I'm starting to feel bad again about some new thing. It just, you know, it's called the doubting disease in French. And I think that's important, because there's something in the brain that doesn't allow you to really feel secure about anything. So if you look at the details, okay, people are afraid they didn't turn their stove off. Why? Because it doesn't feel shut off. They go back and they check it. They walk away. It doesn't feel shut off. They go back. They think, well, maybe I jostled it when I checked it, and now it's really not off. So people check their doors. One of the things that I would say really had a major influence in my life was checking whether I was loved, because I couldn't feel loved. How could I know for sure I was loved? This is another thing I want to say to parents, is that, you know, back in my day, I don't know how much parents hugged and kissed their kids, but my guess is that back in the 70s, parents didn't show as much affection for their children as they do nowadays. I don't blame my parents for that. I think it was a day and age in which we were growing up. But I hope parents today hug and kiss your kids. You cannot over hug and kiss them. when they start saying, mommy, stop it, or daddy, stop it, I'm kissed enough, that's when you stop, because kids need affection. And I will, if I may just share one more quick thing, is that as a child, I just wanted to be held. I was so scared. I just wanted to be held. But the thought of asking to be held and being told no was so scary that I thought it's better to just not ask. If I ask and I'm told no, I'll die. But if I ask and or don't ask, I can always imagine they would say yes, and that will get me through life. So now as an adult, I ask. I am not going to do that anymore. I am going to ask people for what I want. If they say no, I can live with that.
I'll be back with my guest, Brian Kramer, after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Brian Kramer, who recounts what it's like to have OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, in his book, Spring, the First 20 Years. You were describing the stress that you felt, and there's a paragraph in your book where you say you became obsessively aware of your breathing and then your heartbeat. You say, my heart seemed to be pounding in my chest. I was afraid it might stop. I kept thinking about it. I might cause it to stop, just like you were worried that you had caused your aunt to die. If it did stop, I would die and be separated from everyone forever. I would be completely alone, and this was the essence of the repeated nightmare as well. To die was like being awake when everyone else was asleep. It was isolation, aloneness, anxiety, and fear. So you mentioned this in this paragraph, this repeated nightmare. What was that, Ryan?
Well, I actually hope that someday I have that nightmare again as an adult so that I can allow myself to understand it and see it.
Or you know what? Some people say they used to dream about being chased by a monster, and then finally in one dream they turn and face the monster.
I've had that experience, yes, and that has ended those series. In fact, I was dreaming I was being shot, and I kept having that dream again and again and again. And then finally in the dream, I faced the shooter and I said, you know, you really have no power over me. And they didn't. And I've never dreamt that again. But the dream you're referring to, the only way I can describe it is as if I'm being told you must drive. And this is, again, as a child, I'm 7 years old, but you must drive a car backwards from here in California to New York City at 90 miles per hour.
Or I think it's 60 in your book, but 90 miles per hour.
Whatever it is.
Worse.
It was something extreme that
impossible.
But more important than that, I have to comment on this, what you just read about this fear of isolation. I've spent my life studying the paranormal, and I have come to conclude, and maybe because of that experience, I've come to conclude that we are all connected, that the nature of the universe is the opposite of my fear as a child. The nature of the universe is connection. We are all connected. We're like one giant ocean of loving consciousness that is ultimate reality. And so all the things I went through as a child, the fears, everything makes, I understand why that was so terrifying, because it was the opposite of what was true. In fact, I also feared that I was going to somehow be destined for evil against my will, which is another thing that OCD people sometimes worry about. But what I've discovered, if there's any destiny to be had, it's a destiny to be good, to be loving, to be kind, to share with others that we are all interconnected, that there's no evil out there trying to get you. I do think that there's consequences to doing things that aren't loving, but I don't think there's a hell that is a place. I think there could be a hell that's a condition, but that's a temporary condition. And when we turn to the loving light, what people call God, I believe that there's the answer to every longing of the human heart and the answer to every fear of the human heart.
My guest is Brian Kramer, and he has written a second book, Spring, the First 20 Years. And you mentioned you became obsessively aware of your breathing and then your heartbeat. My heart seemed to be pounding in my chest. And Edgar Allan Poe, I think, maybe had a sense of this, because I remember years ago reading a story he wrote called The Telltale Heart.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And did you sometimes think, oh, my heart's beating so loud? And of course, in the story, in Poe's story, nobody else could hear it. They came, but he felt guilty, and he thought, they're surely hearing that beating heart.
We had to read that story in high school, and it actually set off a panic attack in me. So reading The Telltale Heart, the murderer there has buried his victim under the floor, and these officers come in, and he actually sets his chair over the place where the body
takes
is.
Takes him into the room.
Takes him into the room, sets his chair over the body, and the dead man's heart starts beating in his ears. Well, this story just... I'm certain that Edgar Allan Poe was writing about a panic attack and guilt. And so anyway, yeah, that was very dramatic when I had to read that book or that story.
Yeah, when we look back at a lot of these artists who were very creative, we can see them with different eyes, knowing what we know today. For example, you were not told, you were not diagnosed, it was not labeled OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. It was not labeled that. But when you were in high school, the symptoms got so bad that you sought out a counselor in high school. And I just loved reading your relationship with this wonderful counselor, Brian. Mm-hmm. What was he like?
Well, Don Lewis is his name, and I'm very pleased to say his name. He was a counselor at Corning High School for years and years. And in my sophomore year, I had a panic attack, and I ran to see Mr. Lewis. And for 3 years, sophomore, junior, and senior, he met with me basically whatever I needed to meet with him. And he listened. He didn't call it obsessive compulsive disorder. He didn't actually call it a disorder at all, but he listened, and that was what I needed. And 30 years later, 20 years later, I don't know exactly what it was, but about 10 years ago, I went and visited him in his home and thanked him for saving my life back in high school. Again, the power of a single person who takes an interest in someone and listens to them, and without judgment, just lets them talk. Very powerful thing for Mr. Lewis to do for me.
I was so happy to read that, Brian, because nowadays, well, the things that make the news, some teacher makes some false step, and we hear that side. And not so often this, well, it wasn't a teacher, but a staff member at your high school.
Counselor.
Counselor. Mm-hmm. That was so helpful to you at that time when you needed the help.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us his name again.
Don Lewis.
So thank you out there to Mr. Lewis.
Yes.
Well, you struggle with the fact that girls were your friends, but when it came to attraction, it was men that you were attracted to.
Mm-hmm.
And you, even today, you have served as president of what is called PFLAG, Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. And so you do your part to help people, I guess, so that they don't have to go through the trauma that you went through because of your sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, when we hear stories like this, people wonder, whoa, what did this person's parents think? And the day is going to come when they have to sit down with their parents and say, Well, here's my story.
Mm-hmm.
And describe that day for us, Brian.
Okay.
This is toward the end of your book, and this chapter is called Coming Out.
I'm going to read here. We were in my parents' home in Capay. I asked them to sit down in our living room because I had something important to tell them. They sat there while I marched back and forth, repeating that I had something important to tell them, but that it was difficult to say. Finally, after a period of uncomfortable silence, I said, "I need to tell you I'm gay." There was silence. Then my mother started crying, and tears welled up in my father's eyes. I don't remember what was said, but I know I was glad I told them. I had grown up with secrets, and I wasn't about to continue this as an adult. I returned to Chico that day, a freer man, hopeful and anticipating love in my future.
My guest is memoirist Brian Kramer, and he has written his first in a series, I think, of memoirs, Spring, the First 20 Years. And you tell us what's happening back as young as when you were 3 years old and what you went through when nobody had a clue that you were suffering the degree that you were suffering. And you could hardly wait to move out of your parents' home. You go off to university. And what did you study when you got to Chico State?
Well, psychology. I was about to say something disparaging. But, you know, we go into the subjects that we feel we need. And actually, Don Lewis had helped me so much as a counselor that I thought, you know, I want to help people like he helped me. And so I chose psychology, which I'm so glad I did get a degree in psychology. Later, I got a degree in health science and social science as well. But I loved and still love the field.
Well, you've mentioned things that you have discovered truths, if we want to call it that, about how to go about living your life now. And you, so in your book, at one point you wonder, gosh, was this because of a previous life? And so you, I don't know if you're a practicing Catholic now, because I notice you do use the term God, but you also use words like consciousness. And what have you concluded?
Well, I'm actually hoping to start a church of sort. You could call it a fellowship or a gathering, but I call it Celebrating Consciousness in Community. And it can be found on Facebook by simply searching for Celebrating Consciousness in Community, Chico, California. And the goal is to bring people together, to share our lives, to realize that we are all one, that just as there are waves and each wave is an individual, it's still connected to the whole ocean and we're connected to each other. And it makes sense out of all the many aspects of the paranormal, telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, reincarnation, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences. All of these things are tied together and make sense, along with quantum physics, if we are all one. And so that's where I'm at today.
Well, I think a lot of people will be, I don't know, comforted maybe is the word, reading your book. Say, oh, I'm not alone. Somebody else went through something similar, probably not to the degree that you did, but something similar. Thank you so much, Brian, for coming in today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Brian Kramer, a previous book, Why I Slept with My Therapist, and now he has a new book, Spring, the First 20 Years, My Memoirs. And now former Chico News and Review columnist Anthony Peyton Porter tells us about his late wife, Janice.
My wife. This is from 2006. I am married. Married am I. As thoroughly hitched as I am, I felt I should see it at least twice. I've had this wife many years, and I see that the 2 weeks between our first date and our betrothal didn't allow adequate time for a background check and adequate observation of her deep-seated imperialistic tendencies. Now the story must be told. My wife is a queen, but she wants to be an empress of the expansionist persuasion. My sons and I have to be on the alert constantly for incursions into our meager space. At any moment, especially on a Saturday, We could look up from our leisure and espy my wife with that gleam in her eye. It starts mildly, perhaps with, "Is that your pile of stuff?" The pile could be notes for a scholarly treatise, or the scraps of my dear grandmother's letters from the frontiers of metaphysics. It's all stuff to my wife. If a project of hers wants some horizontal space in order to go smoothly, it gets it, no matter what else is going on. My wife's desires for space are actually requirements. She doesn't just want the table. She needs the table. You might think that my family would have continual conflicts around space, but we don't. That's because, like any government, my wife has the power of eminent domain, and she knows how to use it. My wife doesn't have to need a space to commandeer it, though. A while back, the appearance of our youngest son's room somehow offended her delicate sensibilities. She could have ignored the way his room looked. She could have asked him to change it. She could have just closed the door. Instead, while he was away being indoctrinated at school, innocently thinking his one-room kingdom was secure from foreign interference, she took over, laying waste to his comfy chaos. He came home to a space that looked like an exceptionally neat spare bedroom, just short of doilies and shams. My wife is an artist, and her environment is part of her expression, so get with the program. I have explained to her that the boys and I approach shifting piles of clothes as a challenge to our cat-like grace. She is unimpressed. In the garden, she has killed whole beds of periwinkle, several ornamental grasses, and a silver mound artemisia in her quest to plant something else there. Overall, I don't think there's anything my wife likes better than stacking my stuff in the far corner on the floor, thus destroying the subtle elegance of my many smaller piles. We need a bigger house. I'm Anthony Payton Porter.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.